From Sheldon Silver to Michael Grimm, political corruption is becoming so commonplace that it's hard for voters to feel they have a voice. Is there a way for the average citizen to have a say in a pay-to-play system? Panelists include Letitia James, public advocate for New York City, Dick Dady, executive director of Citizens Union, Doug Henwood, economic journalist, Al Vann, former New York State Assemblyman and City Councilman, and others. Once again, that's 7 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, April 8th.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, inviting you to participate in a national international reparations summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York, with Professor Hillary Beckles, representatives of the CARICOM's Reparations Commission, and reparations advocates from the Caribbean, Central and South America, Canada, and Europe. Join us for a welcome rally at Mother AME Zion Church in Harlem, a benefit tribute to Congressman John Conyers with keynote speaker Danny Glover, hosted by 1199, and a climatic closing rally at First AME Zion Church in Brooklyn. Join us in welcoming our sisters and brothers from the Pan-African world for this historic Reparations Summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York. For the full schedule and program, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org, or call 718-429-1415. That's 718-429-1415.
Hey, it's Bonnie Raitt, and you're listening to WBAI FM, my kind of radio. Don't change that dial.
And you are listening to WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock time, once again, for Off the Hook. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Hi.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Yeah, I'm here.
And Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
Welcome to the new Country 99.5.
Nothing but good music.
Country music is back on in New York City.
I'm Kenny Chesney.
Hi, this is Shania Twain.
Hey, y'all, I'm Kix Brooks.
I'm Ronnie Dunn.
And New York's newest radio station, Country 99.5. And now, 10,000 country hits, commercial-free. Country 99.5.
Country 99.5.
Yeah, you know what? We're not doing that. Not doing that again. That's from our April Fool's show of 2009. Brings back some memories, doesn't it?
I don't want to hear that again.
I don't want to hear that again either. I don't even know how that happened. Folks, this... You know, I know it's April Fool's. I really do. And I appreciate that. I'm just not in the mood. Is anyone else in the mood for this? Because, you know, a lot of jokes, a lot of buffoonery going on, but there's also a lot of serious things to talk about. Don't you agree?
There are. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bernie, what?
I think we should stick to the facts.
Well, someone has to. You know, it's important that people know they can turn to us. And especially, you can't turn to us next week. That's not an April Fool's joke. We won't be on next week. There's some kind of town hall thing that's being broadcast instead. But we'll be on in 2 weeks. So that makes this week all the more important as far as covering news items. And a bunch of us have some news items that are important to share with people. And, Mike, you want to start? You have something there?
Yeah, sure. I have the latest on the Silk Road saga.
Oh, boy.
It's from Andy Greenberg, who, if you'll believe me, he writes for Wired now.
Okay, that's believable.
And so it's about this DA agent whose name is Karl Marx Force the Fourth. I can't even say that.
Mike, okay. At both the Monday and Tuesday night pre-show meetings, we were very, very clear as far as not having any silly stories tonight with silly made-up names. And I'm just
I'm not making anything
cautioning
of this
story. You know, if you're going to do something like this, at least be imaginative and use a name that is somewhat believable. Karl
Marx Force the Fourth. I mean, with a name like that, you sort of have to be a DEA agent. What else can you do? The story is for Monday. It's not an April 1st story.
You know, I'm gonna humor you, but I'm cautioning you as well to tread lightly. Go ahead.
Okay, so Mr. Force the Fourth. Who's at the DA, and Sean Bridges, also a real name, from the Secret Service, were investigating the Dread Pirate Roberts from the Silk Road, but they themselves were arrested on Monday and charged with wire fraud and money laundering. Because I guess they took some of the Bitcoins that were coming from the Silk Road, and rather than depositing them into the government Bitcoin account, which I guess is a thing that exists, they took it for themselves. And so Bridges accused of placing $800,000 of Bitcoins into a personal account and charged with I don't know, what else would they be charged with? Theft of government property, conflict of interest. You know, I was reading the affidavit into this, signed by Mr. I guess
yeah,
it's a
ought
mister.
To be, this ought to be good. What's his name?
The IRS agent, and actually I don't know the person's gender, Tigran Gambaryan.
All right, I'm gonna stop you right there.
Yeah.
Rob, you have a serious story, hopefully, for us?
Emmanuel, this is a serious story.
Uh-huh, okay.
The DEA is stolen all this money. This guy's got some serious jail time ahead of him.
Serious jail time, yes. I'm
serious.
Sure.
I mean, I can see why you would think it's a joke, right? That like police officers would ever get in trouble for being corrupt, but that's what's happening here. Mr. Force, he once sent a message, signed it. His first name is Carl, and he once signed a message, Carl, which is not a great thing to do if you're trying to hide from your employer. So he made up a pseudonym, Carla Sophia.
Okay.
Which also known as the French Maid. And he's got another pseudonym, Death from Above.
Okay, are you about done? Yeah. I mean, this is...
And so he tried to, like, sell
it's
information.
It's not a comic book show here. We're talking about serious
This
issues.
Is serious.
Death from Above?
This is Wired Magazine, a very serious publication,
well,
despite their, like, new weird typography.
Thought so until now. Okay, anything you want to sum up for this little escapade here?
You should read the criminal complaint. It reads like a novel, but it's really filed in court, and it's quite some stuff.
All right. Well, that's and if you want more information on that, go to wired.com and find out. Yes.
I think this just teaches us all not to trust French maids called Karl Marx Fox Force 5 the 4th or
Death from above.
It's a good name.
You know, we could have done so much better than this. We really could have. If we had decided to go this route, we would have.
It's a serious business.
I mean, the facts of the names, we could have come up with more realistic names. But the facts of the case, I don't know if I could have come up with. There's murder for hire. It's a lot of stuff.
I don't think he's lying.
All right, fine. Rob, I hope you have something a bit more serious than this.
I do. Some time ago, civil asset forfeiture was in the news, where if you're accused of a crime, or even if you're not accused of a crime, the authorities can basically take your stuff and have it for their own. And the president of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama, has basically decided that, you know, this is actually a good tool, and we should be using it on the national level, not only to punish sort of minor criminals, but we should be using it to punish hackers who are cyber threats. And not only that, but hackers who are cyber threats from foreign lands.
See, Rob, if I was going to be as cruel to you as you were to me, I would say Barack Obama's a made-up name.
But enough people have heard of Barack Obama, I think, at this point.
And you keep saying cyber, which makes me not want to believe you either.
Well, cool your cyber jets, because there's more to this story. The cyber president, Barack Cyber Obama, has decided to sign an executive order that basically lets the federal government seize the assets and transactions of people who are perpetrating cyber attacks against American interests.
Cyber American interests.
Cyber American cyber interests.
The actual president of the United States said cyber this many times.
He cyber did.
We agreed to cover serious stories. I cover a serious story. But now you're coming up with this utter, cyber nonsense.
Well, this is cyber serious business. There's even,
When was this announcement made?
This announcement was made today, on the 1st of April, yes.
But why would they make such a cyber serious announcement today on the 1st of
April? Because, Rob, I mean...
This has come from multiple cyber sources. The president himself made a post to Medium.com, which you might know as a popular
Medium.
Yeah, it's a popular
it's
cyber
Medium,
site.
Medium like the psychics.
Correct. Or like in between large and small. And he wrote on here a whole thing about this executive order that he has signed. Saying that cyber intrusions and attacks, and this is a direct quote, cyber intrusions and attacks, many of them originating overseas, are targeting our businesses, stealing trade secrets, and costing American jobs. Iranian hackers have targeted American banks. The North Korean cyber attack on Sony Pictures, this being a story that we've spoken before of on this program, destroyed data and disabled thousands of computers. In other recent breaches that have made headlines, more than 100 million Americans had their personal data compromised, including credit card and medical information. And so we now have an executive order signed by the president himself. Which blocks the property of certain persons engaging in significant malicious cyber-enabled activities.
Blocks the property.
Yes.
I'll only accept this, Rob, if he cyber-signed it, like a digital signature or something. If he did it with a pen.
I think it might have been an auto pen, but this was the actual title of this, and you can find it on the White House official cyber site, is blocking the property of certain persons engaging in significant malicious cyber-enabled activities. Cyber-enabled activities, you guys.
Okay, you got greedy. Yeah, I mean, this cyber-enabled activities, a phrase like that would never come out of government. No, I'm sorry.
That's a good one.
Yeah, come on, Rob.
Well, you guys are, I'll be the one laughing when you guys get your cyber assets cyber seized because you threatened American commercial interests, like those delicate flowers at Sony Pictures.
I got to say, you guys really put one over on me. I thought we were going to do a serious show here tonight, but apparently there was some conspiring in the background. Bernie, you're in Philadelphia, so I know you can't possibly be a part of this. Do you have anything that might add some seriousness to this?
I do, but I hope you don't cyber block this.
I'll try not to. We'll see, though.
Okay. Well, today, Verizon announced, quote, Verizon takes customer privacy seriously.
Bernie, that is the kind of thing they would truly say, but you don't expect us to believe that Verizon takes privacy seriously.
Okay. Well, if I say something else, how about if I say Super Cookie? Does that make you hungry? Super Cookie?
I ate before I came, but Verizon takes our Super Cookie seriously.
Go. Well, apparently...
I want to believe you. Go on.
We've talked about this Super Cookie on this very show more than once. And over the past year, and this is, I'm just documenting what we said earlier this year about this story. So you know I'm not making it up now for April Fools.
Bernie, can I ask a question?
If you stop breathing helium, yes.
I don't know what you're talking about. The Super Cookie, are you serious?
I think the Super Cookie has helium nuggets in it.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, for the past year, Mr. Helium Inhaler, is that still legal, by the way? Verizon has been inserting a unique identifier into the headers of all the web traffic that its mobile users make. Like, if you go to any website using HTTP, not HTTPS, Verizon was inserting this long, unique string of characters that was assigned just specially for you. And unlike a regular cookie, you could not change your browser, configure your browser to reject, to not accept cookies. You could not delete these super cookies. They were embedded in any HTTP traffic you did over a Verizon mobile phone. So,
Ray, what I don't understand, there is a thing called a cookie in real life. but there isn't a thing called a super cookie in real life. So what is that? What is that parallel to?
What is a super cookie parallel to?
I know what a cookie is. I don't know what a super cookie is.
A super cookie is one that you can't shed yourself of. You cannot eat it. You cannot break it into little crumbles. You cannot dip it into milk. It is stuck on your all your web traffic. Whenever you visited a website from via a Verizon wireless cell phone, you could not get rid of this. Verizon would always send this unique identifier to any website that you visited if it was HTTP. So the story I'm going to announce today on April Fool's is that after a year, including angry letter from several U.S. senators to Verizon CEO, that they were going to stop inserting this unique identifier called a UIDH on all of our web traffic, and that there is a phone number that subscribers can call to finally opt out of this. After a year, you could not opt out of this, and I'm saying...
Barney, you have the phone number?
I do.
All right, guys, do you want to hear the phone number?
I would love to hear a phone number.
You guys all want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay.
I only want to hear it if it's a real Verizon phone number. I don't want you giving out, like, random people's phone numbers.
It could be dial-a-joke for all we know. But
definitely give it out. Definitely give the phone number out.
All right, so it's unanimous.
The phone number is to opt out of the Verizon Super Cookie, if you use Verizon Wireless, is toll-free 866- 211-0874. Call before midnight tonight, 866-211-0874, to get rid of your Verizon Wireless Super Cookies.
087 what?
4. 0874, right?
I think that's what it is.
All right.
866-211-0874.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Bernie, thanks for that. That was the least silly of the stories, even though... You did get into that whole thing about super cookies, which I think...
The silliest part of Emmanuel was Verizon saying, Verizon takes customer service, customer privacy seriously.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, I suppose that is a bit humorous. So, Kyle, okay, looks like you have something a bit more serious, hopefully.
I just want to get this in. This is quick but important. I wanted to update people. They've announced in London the UK will have its first micro pig cafe, and it's going to be opening, offering visitors a chance to eat and drink alongside cute little piglets. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
I
guess they're having their first event, and that's going to be kicking it off.
Cute little what's now?
Pigs.
Okay. All right. Pigs.
It's a micro pig cafe. All right. I'm trying to finish this.
Tiny pigs.
Yes. Very tiny pigs. They're well behaved, I think.
There's a phone ringing here, and I don't know where the phone is. You hear that? Where is that phone? Can someone find the phone and unplug it? Because there's not supposed to be a phone in here. Oh, I get it. This is another April Fool's thing. Very funny to everybody. Everybody. Yeah. The joke's on me.
In any event. The event will have three rooms, including a picnic area, and a pig film will be screened at the end of the night.
A pig film?
Yes.
How is this in any way related to anything? Now, these aren't even real pigs.
No, I'm glad you asked.
Yeah.
And most people aren't aware of this, but owning a micro pig is complex. It's a challenging thing, and it takes the spirit of a hacker to get through. There's a lot of milestones in a piglet's growth, and
a piglet, a little pig, a baby pig, or you're saying micro pig, like that's a thing.
I think these are an actual breed that is like a micro, a very small dog or a small, but it's a small breed of pig. They're very in right now.
Pigs are already kind of small. I mean, unless you feed them a lot and then they get huge, but
yeah.
But I've seen, how big are these? Is that a picture you're holding up?
I think you can fit like half a dozen in your shopping bag or so, but they're like teacup size, like baby.
Teacup size pigs?
Yeah.
Wow. Hi.
Wow.
Well, yes.
I'm amazed.
Are these dwarf pigs or midget pigs?
I don't think you can use that word, Bernie.
I don't want to get into too many of the linguistic attributes because I don't want to mislead people, Bernie, but that is a good question. I'll leave that to other people to research. But people are buying them, apparently, as accessories, kind of like you would have, like, a headband or like, jewelry or something. But they don't realize that they grow, and that's actually a big problem. But this way, you can go, you can visit, you can have your cup of tea with the pigs, and you're not actually taking on this creature as a pet, and so on.
You know, absurd and ridiculous as that story you just read is, it is, I think, the least silly of the stories that have been read in the last few minutes. So I don't know how to interpret that myself.
They've got plans for penguins in the future, by the way.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yes,
so,
Mike.
So, Kyle, you're claiming this is like a cat cafe, but with micro pigs?
Yes. Yeah.
That's
exactly what it's like.
I mean, I see a photograph here, but I don't know what you're talking about.
Hold that up to the microphone.
It's pet piggy. The hat is really cute. The piglet's wearing a little sun hat, which is really adorable. If you like.
Nature would never have created this. No, a pig should not be that small.
I can tell by the pixels this is fake.
No. This is like incredibly serious. I'm not doing that.
It doesn't exist. Or
there's a picture right here.
Yeah, but look at the pixels. Just look at them.
Look at this. That's a teacup. There's like four.
All right. You know,
I don't know. I mean, like,
go ahead, Bernie.
Are these pigs, because they're so tiny, are they light enough to fly?
Oh, I see what you're doing there, Bernie. No, I'm not going to fall into that trap. You guys, I said I wasn't going to do this. I know it's April Fool's, but I am only sticking to the real stuff with the show. I mean, no, you can't get me to do it.
We're not trying to get you to do it. We're trying to get you not to do it.
I don't want
to. We all picked our own stories,
I
don't know.
This is real news.
I'm dubious about this. I like, you know, a little honey in my tea, a little lemon. I don't like piglets in my tea.
Okay, you know what?
No. You eat with them. You don't eat the piglets.
If this is how it's going to be, if people are going to take this as non-seriously as you seem to be, when I thought we had something serious planned, sure, I can just go on the internet and do the same thing. I can tell you that the NSA is claiming that it really wanted to stop the phone spying program, but then Edward Snowden came along and leaked all that information, and they couldn't do it anymore. Huh? How's that? How's that for a joke? Yeah, funny, huh? Doesn't feel so good coming from the other side, does it? And now they're facing a real problem with recruitment for some reason that they can't figure out. Huh?
I don't know. You can do better than that.
I mean, yeah, that seems pretty believable.
All right, I actually do. I have a better story that I just found on an Onion-like site. Remember the Hillary Clinton thing with the emails and all that?
Yes, indeed.
Well, she apparently had about 60,000 emails that were sent on that private server of hers, and through a Freedom of Information Act from the Associated Press, a total of four have been. Have been released. I know this is really.
It wasn't working very hard.
Yeah, it's kind of. I know they could have written this better. Four. That's just so unbelievable. Okay, the four emails were obtained by the Freedom of Information request. Let's just suspend our disbelief for a moment, and offer one of the first looks into Clinton's correspondence at the State Department. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at her email and see what she said. Okay, in reply to a message sent in September 2011 by advisor Huma Abedin, and you can look that up, that's a real name, to Clinton's personal email account, which contained an AP story about a drone strike in Pakistan. This is real, okay, serious. Clinton replied, "I like the idea of these. How high are they? What would the bench be made of? And I'd prefer two shelves or attractive boxes / baskets / containers on one. What do you think?" All right, huh? Yeah, okay, yeah, it feels good to make a joke. I agree, it does.
Emmanuel, that's, I think, a real story.
Well, you think all these stories are real.
I mean, the ones that other people have told are clearly fake, but I read a real story, and you read a real story. I think we should conspire against these liars.
It goes on. Abedin replied, "Did you mean to send that to me?" And Clinton responded, "No, sorry. Also, please let me know if you got a reply from my iPad. I'm not sure replies go through." Well, I guess you can't make that up.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, that seems too boring to make up.
All right, I'm going to make one more attempt, and then I'm out of ideas. Here's a story that I thought was very poorly done because it's just so contrived and the kind of thing that we see on television all the time. You got this guy, right? His name, let's just call him Neil Moore, all right? It's a good name for just a guy, a bloke over in England, yeah. He was in prison, and he basically he got himself an illicit mobile telephone, created a fake email account, and then made a website that was very similar to that of the court service's official address. He then emailed the prison's custody inbox with instructions for his release, and then he was released. How is that for a story that, if you had taken just a few more minutes, you probably could have made a much better plot out of that. But that is what this April Fool's story is claiming happened.
Neil Moore, really?
Neil Moore. Yeah, isn't that something? I guess there's a joke in there, too. And they only found out about it when they when his lawyers went to talk to him in prison and he wasn't there. and the whole ruse kind of unraveled from that point.
Emmanuel.
Yes, Bernie.
You expect us to believe that he did all this?
No.
Created a website and from a mobile phone? And do you expect that the prison officials in the UK would fall for such a stupid thing? You really expect to believe that?
You know what? I'm sorry, because I don't expect you. It was a half-hearted attempt on my part to join in the fun, which obviously I was not a part of. And I'm sorry. It obviously was a poor story and lacked imagination, exactly the kind of thing you'd expect to see on primetime TV.
I mean, this is from the BBC, this story, and usually when they make stuff, it's better. Like the spaghetti, the classic spaghetti thing, that was at least funny. This is just...
Yeah. What can we say? We tried, folks. We tried.
I can't tell what's real and what isn't.
Well, one thing I can tell you that is real...
Welcome to the new Country 99.5.
Okay, all right. That's not funny anymore. Fine. We have letters. We have real listeners who really write to us and really want answers because we don't seem to give enough answers out there. We're going to read some of those. And we'll also take phone calls later on. 212-209-2900 is our telephone number. Hey, guys, I'm catching last week's show a bit late. You know, it doesn't matter when you listen, as long as you listen at some point. Astounding story about that fine levied on the small television station. We talked about that.
For quite a while.
Huge. Yes, we did. Well, it was a good conversation about the TV station that inadvertently showed an erect penis on the air. And the FCC was not very much amused by that.
What's that?
The point is, they didn't see it themselves in their editing bay because their screens apparently were smaller than the screens of people with fancy television sets who did see it.
Right.
It lasted about 3 seconds and shocked that particular part of the country. And now there's a huge fine. I'll probably put that station out of business. Anyway, continuing with this letter, your discussion about aggressively suppressing mature content reminded me of a book first published in 1899 called Studies in the Psychology of Sex, by Havelock Ellis, and that is a real name, so you can just stop laughing now. Havelock. All right, those of you searching for a name for your kid, Havelock, spelled the way it sounds. I've never heard that name before.
Havelock will travel.
Yeah, he's going to have one fun school time, that's for sure. It's kids like you to hound him. Havelock Ellis. Anyway, he makes incredibly brilliant remarks in the preface concerning the reticent approach to discussing sexuality. And this is what he said back in 1899. Let my friends try to transfer their feelings and theories from the reproductive region to, let us say, the nutritive region, the only other which can be compared to it for importance. Suppose that eating and drinking were never spoken of openly, save in veiled or poetic language, and that no one ever ate food publicly because it was considered immoral and immodest to reveal the mysteries of this natural function. We know what would occur. A considerable proportion of the community, more especially the more youthful members, possessed by an instinctive and legitimate curiosity, would concentrate their thoughts on the subject. They would have so many problems to puzzle over. How often ought I to eat? What ought I to eat? Is it wrong to eat fruit, which I like? They talked weird back then. Ought I to eat grass, which I don't like? Instinct notwithstanding, we may be quite sure that only a small minority would succeed in eating reasonably and wholesomely. The sexual secrecy of life is even more disastrous than such a nutritive secrecy would be, partly because we expend such a wealth of moral energy in directing or misdirecting it, partly because the sexual impulse normally develops at the same time as the intellectual impulse, not in the early years of life when wholesome instinctive habits might be formed. And there is always some ignorant and foolish friend who is prepared still further to muddle things, eat a meal every other day, eat 12 meals a day, never eat fruit, always eat grass. The advice emphatically given in sexual matters is usually not less absurd than this. When, however, the matter is fully open, The problems of food are not indeed wholly solved, but everyone is enabled by the experience of his fellows to reach some sort of situation suited to his own case. And when the rigid secrecy is once swept away, a sane and natural reticence becomes, for the first time, possible. And you can read that whole book on Project Gutenberg. I want to thank that longtime listener from the Pacific Northwest for writing in with that. Studies in the Psychology of Sex, Havelock Ellis. Think he makes a lot of sense.
He does. And in some ways, it's good to know that people were even discussing that sort of thing back then. But in some ways, it's like, how much further along are we in that particular conversation 116 years later?
Not as far as I would like to be.
Not much further. But I think the one thing to keep in mind, especially with these, is that social mores and people's sensitivities and the ideologies of the time, they vary over time a lot. And they can ebb and flow, kind of go one way and then the other. Just something to point out.
Well, here's a story that actually happened, really happened. I'm not trying this again, but there was another television station, this time in San Francisco, KRON. For 6 minutes on Friday, they had a scroll going underneath a story that I can't say on the air, but you can figure out what I mean. Effing BS, scrolling across the bottom of the screen along with other news items. This is while Hulk Hogan was being interviewed in preparation for WrestleMania weekend. And you can see it right there. It's not an April Fool's joke. That happened. And I can't find any mention of this anyplace. And maybe we just got KRN into a whole lot of trouble.
So someone who was programming that was somehow able to, or was dissenting while this guy was being interviewed something?
Or that's a breaking news item of some sort, but I kind of doubt that. Yeah, these things do happen. And, I decided, why not look at the way a different country might do something? I looked up Canada's rules on this. You know, they are our nation to the north.
I mean, you know, Canada's not an independent country.
Well, it's independent enough, as far as I'm concerned. And sometimes they get things a lot more right than we do. All right. In this particular case, I think this is one of them. They have something known as the Broadcasting Act. That was made in 1991. Actually, a prior version of the Broadcasting Act received royal assent in 1936, subsequently updated in 1958 and 1968. The 1958 Act created the Board of Broadcast Governors to replace the CBC as a regulatory arm for broadcasting in Canada. And in 1968, the CRTC was created to also keep track of all this and be the equivalent of the FCC. Now, basically, the Act imposes a Canadian-owned and controlled system of broadcasting, includes provisions regarding Canadian content and programming and production, which is kind of silly in many ways. It's the reason why you can't hear CBC Radio 2 on satellite in the States, because it doesn't have enough Canadian content, so they can't broadcast it on satellite. But a lot of that is kind of defensive against the Americanization of broadcasting over there. But looking up their rules as far as indecency and obscenity, it's really, really hard to find any examples because it's not as big a deal for them up there. They rely more on voluntary self-governing by the stations themselves. They have what's known as a watershed, 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Now, basically, Canadian broadcast stations, they can broadcast sexually explicit or violent programming under certain circumstances, albeit with viewer discretion advisories and at adult-oriented times on the schedule. There's a commercial network up there called CTV. They have aired controversial series like The Sopranos, Nip Tuck, The Osbournes. Yeah, some real cutting-edge stuff there. In prime time without editing. And that's not something we can do here. Some Canadian television broadcasters, such as City TV, have aired softcore pornography after 12 midnight, which can therefore be viewed as early as 9 p.m. in other parts of Canada. The Code of Ethics of the Canadian Association of Broadcasters defines the late viewing period as the hours from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Outside this period, the Code of Ethics prohibits programming containing sexually explicit material or coarse or offensive language. The association also publishes a voluntary code regarding violence in television programming. They take that more seriously, actually. Now, enforcing these two codes, the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council permits nudity to be broadcast during the day as long as it's considered non-sexual. For example, They permitted a 4 p.m. broadcast of the movie Wildcats, containing male frontal nudity in a locker room scene and female nudity in a bathtub. And they've also permitted the film Striptease, which contains scenes of bare female breasts, to be shown at 8 p.m. So, yeah, you know, in Canada, it's a bit more sane. And I think that's something we need to look at and not be so freaked out over what are obvious mistakes or just simply different values.
Emmanuel.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Did you know that the United States of America also has a broadcasting board of governors?
Well, who are they beholden to?
It's the United States government operates it is the broadcasting board of governors of the United States of America. The broadcasts that they govern, though, are the international shortwave broadcasts that the United States, like Voice of America, Radio Sawa, which is a CIA front for Arab stations in the Middle East. And you know who's in charge of the United States Broadcasting Board of Governors?
I'm not even going to try to guess. Tell me.
A guy named Jeffrey Schell. He's the former chairman of NBC Universal. And before that, he was the president of Comcast Programming. So this is the guy, he's the chair of the United States Broadcasting Board of Governors, who oversees what kind of programming he thinks is appropriate for the United States to be broadcasting to foreign lands. Isn't that interesting?
It's interesting. I'm not sure how many people actually listen to shortwave anymore.
I do.
Okay, so what besides crazy religious garbage comes from the United States?
Well, there's by federal law for many years, broadcast to U.S. citizens, shortwave broadcast to U.S. citizens are prohibited. However, there's a number of shortwave stations in the United States that broadcast to foreign countries, like WBCQ up in Maine on 7490 kilohertz, broadcast to Mexico. It's really a free station. We actually used to be simulcast on WBCQ years ago. I listen to Radio Havana, Cuba on a great frequency, 6,000 kilohertz, 6000.
Okay, but we don't broadcast, do we? No, we don't broadcast. That's them that doing that.
Yes,
as far as what we broadcast,
broadcast in shortwave to other countries?
Yeah, just Voice of America and WBCQ.
WBCQ, there's a station down in, I forget the call letters for it, but there's a station down in Florida that broadcasts a variety of content. It's not bad. But you're right.
It is, bad. It's pretty bad. I mean, even WBCQ has crazy religious stuff on because they pay for it.
They got to pay the bills.
Yeah, and it's not the way shortwave used to be. It used to be
interesting. You're absolutely right. But it's still an interesting medium. And what's interesting is when you're listening to shortwave, unlike internet streaming stuff, you don't know. You know that no one knows what you're listening to and what you're listening to and when. Like, you know.
As long as you keep it to yourself,
there's no super cookies involved on the radio.
There's the U.S. The Broadcasting Board of Governors in particular, but the U.S. government, funds a lot of propaganda, not just Voice of America, but also Radio Marti, which is targeted at Cuba, although mostly blocked by the Cuban government. So it's not clear who's listening, but we're paying for it anyway. They're very busy in the propaganda,
Radio
department.
Sama is very popular in the Middle Eastern region, but it's funded by the U.S. government and supervised by the CIA.
One quick fun fact about Voice of America is their facilities aren't actually fully used at the moment. They've been shutting things down. And there's a ship, Blackbeard's ship, Queen Anne's Revenge, is being restored in one of the warehouse buildings at the site. I think that's in Ohio, Bernie. Do you know where that's?
No, but this is really interesting.
I was reading up about Voice of America not too long ago, and basically I was researching that site and looking at some of the pictures of the antenna arrays, and they've been slowly shutting down some of the broadcast facilities there. I think just one of the arrays is working currently, but if you do a little research, there's kind of an interesting fact that on that very site, Queen Anne's Revenge, that shipwreck which was found on the East Coast here, is being restored, or it's otherwise being located there.
Interesting stuff.
They can turn it into a radio ship, I think.
I thought that was, I was like, oh, that's such a hilarious connection. I mean, do they realize the sort of irony that this pirate ship is on this broadcasting site?
Okay, I'd like to move on to another letter that somebody else wrote in to us concerning the topic we were discussing. I listened to your March 25th, 2015 show. I'd like to make a few comments regarding your reporting of the FCC fine imposed on WDBJ-TV. I think that any reasonable person would conclude that the station did not intentionally broadcast the offending image. I'd be interested to hear from a legal expert considering regarding the likelihood of the fine being successfully contested. I did find it a bit distasteful that you would bash George W. Bush for signing a law passed by both houses of Congress. Why didn't you bash Barack Obama since he was president when the fine was imposed? The FCC is an independent agency of the U.S. government. Its commissioners are equally divided by Republican and Democratic employees. Any bad decisions that they arrive at are not the fault of any one party or any one president. Neither party is more to blame than the other. They share the blame. Instead of grousing about government officials assaulting our freedoms, why don't you invite onto your show local politicians who are running for office and are championing issues of freedom? I know you don't want to hear this, but you have more in common with the Tea Party than you think. Yeah, I just love it when people tell me who I have something in common with that I don't know. I'm a libertarian, I'm a conservative, I'm all sorts of crazy things. You know, George W. Bush is the guy who signed the bill, okay? Yeah, Barack Obama was in office when this fine was handed out, but you can't just unravel all this. If he tried, then he'd have all kinds of people coming after him, and I don't think we'd support him because he's not going far enough. The whole thing is really silly. What you missed is that I bashed George W. Bush for creating ISIL. You didn't mention that. And how this guy is still walking around free is beyond me. You know, he started this war that killed, I think, over a million people and threw the world into turmoil that I don't know how we're ever going to piece back together. That is something that I think is worthy of discussion. As for politicians getting on the radio, I don't think so. Not on our show. We have more important issues to talk about. Even the micro pigs are more important than the politicians, as far as I'm concerned. Mike.
I would just say that I don't think any regular listener to the show would fail to notice that we're perfectly happy to criticize President Clinton when he, as he so often does things that are wrong.
And President Obama, too.
President Obama, yes. All the presidents, really.
President Clinton, yes.
Yeah, President Coolidge, if he's doing something wrong, all of them.
All right. Well, anyway, thanks for that letter, though. OTH at 2600.com is our phone number, is our email address. Our phone number is 212-209-2900. Rob, you have something.
I should also mention that we're not opposed in general to having politicians on the show who are willing to answer the questions that we would ask them. I'm reminded of the last time we had a mayoral candidate on the show, Billy Talon, also known as Reverend Billy, and I think that was a good episode. You can find it in our archives.
Right. Oh, Emmanuel.
Hello? Go ahead, yeah.
I just want to say, I was in a Verizon Wireless store today, and I talked with a customer service representative named John. And he actually is an off-the-hook listener. And his sister turned him on to the show. And I just left. We have listeners everywhere.
Is that your final try for an April Fool's joke? That you just happened to run into somebody who listens to the show?
I know. It's implausible.
All right.
I thought I'd try.
212-209-2900 is our telephone number. Let's see who's out there. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello? Can anyone hear me?
Yeah, listener, you're on the air. We're taking calls. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I agree with everything Emmanuel just said.
Okay. Emmanuel was just commenting about...
I think a lot of listeners are going to say the same thing.
Emmanuel, was that you somehow? I mean, I see you right here, so I don't know how you could have done it, but... no one agrees with everything you say.
Well, there are people out there who do. And a lot of them are Tea Party people, apparently. 212-209-2900. Let's see who else agrees with me. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Whoops, I gotta go. Bye.
That was me. All right.
Man, I thought he'd never leave.
212-209-2900 is our telephone number. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, let me shut my radio. Okay, it's off. I'm going to finish what I had to say about the Hillary Clinton thing. I'm the guy who was referred to as a chap by the guy named Dave.
Oh, boy. This is going to go on forever, isn't it?
I'm going to try to wrap it up unless I get more, more responses. But anyway,
if you say something tonight, you will get more responses. But, we can't keep going forever. But give us a summation, and then we'll comment on it afterwards.
Okay, real quick, he misquoted me somewhere along the line. But anyway, I still say that ClintonEmail.com is in Palmetto Bay, Florida, where I said it was in the first place. It points to inbound10.mxlogic.net in White Plains, which is owned by McAfee. And basically, according to Mashable.com, Hillary's server wasn't with MX Logic until after she left the State Department, and they questioned the security on that site. I didn't know about before MX Logic, but the only thing I can say is McAfee's servers are very well secured. Even if they don't use encryption, to try to port scan it, they drop packets left and right. So basically, I think that the email servers are very secure, and that's about it. There's nothing more to say. I don't know where else it points to. That guy Dave was correct about the load balancing on the big IP server that Hillary has in Florida. So that's basically it. That's the last I have to say about it so far.
Thanks a lot, Denali, for the update.
Yes.
Definitely, it sounds like you've gone as far as you can go in that direction insofar as understanding how that is set up. But definitely good to check all the possibilities there.
Yeah, I don't want to discourage anybody from looking into this, but we have to be open to corrections and additional information being sent in as well. And I think what this caller has done is gotten people talking about it. That's the important thing. And you know, some of you out there, you know, you gotta ease up a little bit, because not everybody is going to instantly understand every aspect of this. At the level you might understand it. And if you are an expert on this, tell us something. Tell us not just that this guy doesn't have all the information. Tell us the information you can figure out. Here's something that our own Junce wrote in, which I think is pretty helpful. FYI, MX Logic, which is now McAfee Security as a Service, SaaS, is exactly what others have already mentioned in response to this chap's assertions. Are we going to refer to him that way from now on?
It's weird phrasing, but is it an insult?
It's what the caller last week referred to him as repeatedly, so I guess that's his name now. Anyway, it's only the first stop on the route to their actual mail server. You still have to run your own mail server somewhere, but you point your MX record at McAfee SaaS's IP. So they receive your mail, scan it for viruses, spam, whatever else you can configure it to scan for. If I was working for McAfee, I'd be scanning it for all kinds of secrets of security and international intrigue and things like that, but I don't. Then it gets passed along to your real mail server, and I don't believe we know where that is exactly. They don't exactly, that's me saying that, they don't actually store any of your mail on their systems, nor do you access it from there. At least you hope they don't store it on their systems. They certainly could, because it's passing through their systems, and I'm not in any way saying that they do this. I'm just saying that whenever you have mail going to a service any place, that's a point where something could happen if it's unencrypted. Junce goes on to say that this guy's looking at whatever the MX record points to and making the incorrect assumption that it's Hillary's mail server. Unless he can hack into McAfee's system and get to Hillary's account info to determine the IP of the actual mail server, all of this is a pointless exercise. I don't know if it's a pointless exercise. I think it's an exercise. I think it gets us talking and thinking about what we can do to figure out where exactly this is and just how upset we'll get people when we try to figure out how Hillary gets her email.
I also want to point out that it's never cool to just criticize somebody who's putting something out there for being wrong, because they're still exploring. And that is the way to go. That's the hacker spirit. That's the hacker mindset. That's what we're all about around
Absolutely.
Here is exploring to the best of your ability. And if you see somebody doing that and maybe think they're not going down the right path, then rather than just try and tear them down, the best move is always to contribute what you've got to add to the discussion, and everyone benefits and everyone wins.
So I'm very happy this guy has taken the time to look into this and get us talking about it, and I hope he continues to do that to both this and other things. And I hope other people do the same. In fact, this might be a great opportunity to mention that there's 2600 meetings this Friday where you can meet people that do that kind of thing all the time, right?
Yes, indeed. We meet here in the city at the Citigroup Center, 53rd Street and Lexington Avenue, Friday night, and they're happening all over the world. Check 2600.com/meetings for one near you.
Over the world, except in Israel, where they happen on Thursdays.
Yes, indeed.
But everywhere else, Fridays. And go to 2600.com/meetings, and you'll get all the information there.
And if there isn't near one going on near you, you can always start it, and the info for that is right there.
That's right. Absolutely. Okay, let's take another phone call. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yeah, hi. I heard that there.
Do you remember this voice?
Smartphones have.
Wow, talk about someone calling from the past.
FM antenna that can pick up FM signals like radio.
Hasn't changed at all.
Is this true? And if it is, what? Because I had a cell phone one time that was like before Bluetooth, it was one of those flip phones that. You broadcast, it would be a broadcasting thing where you play your MP3s through like an FM little transmitter in the cell phone that you tune to like 88.1 or whatever vacant station that doesn't have anything on the air.
Bernie, you want to answer that?
Rebel, what's your question concisely?
Why would you ask him to do that?
Can a smartphone have a chip that is actually a FM antenna? Because I know, I've heard this on the radio, that cell phone companies do not want the FM antenna to be activated because they want people to stream music online and use their data plan.
There's an interesting battle going on between the National Association of Broadcasters.
That is a good point.
Who's trying to push Congress or bribe Congress to pass a bill that would mandate, would require the FCC to mandate that all cell phones have an FM radio chip in them. So they could receive FM radio broadcasts. The ostensible argument behind that is that when the cell phone networks go down, you could pick up emergency messages over the FM radio band. But most phones, my BlackBerry Z30 has an FM radio in it, and you do have to plug in earphones to use the antenna. My mother has a track phone with an FM radio in it that you don't need to plug an antenna into. It just works fine. It's actually a pretty good little FM radio. So to answer your question, there are some cell phones with FM radios in them. Some you have to plug, like the earphones, into the antenna, and others you don't have to. And I'd like more phones to have FM radios in it. I just don't think it should be mandated by the FCC.
I have a handset that has the exact same thing. Basically, the headphones act as an antenna. I also had a very old Nokia, like very small, like candy bar form factor, which had a FM radio in it as well. Really an old phone. It's probably almost 10, 12 years old by now. But it was the same idea. You plug in your headphones and the antenna is, then the functionality works, but it uses a separate chip or antenna to pick up those waves.
Anyway, thanks to Rebel for calling in. Good to hear his voice again after all these years.
Or was that some recording you played as an April Fool's
joke? No, it was not a recording. That was real. I think it was real. Someone else could have been playing a recording, I suppose. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. That's a recording. All right, let's take this one instead. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Oh, okay. Hey, how you doing?
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to turn off the phone real quick. Are you guys familiar with NSPD number 16?
We can't really talk about that on the radio, can we? No, I have no idea what you're talking about. Tell us this is.
No, because you just spoke about it with, I don't know if it was April Fool's or you said something about.
We don't even know. Specifically, what was it?
Well, you were talking about cyber warfare, right?
Yes. I believe that was you, Rob.
We were talking about cyber threats and from overseas threatening American cyber interests.
What's your question?
Well, my question is, this is National Security Presidential Directive 16, which orders or allows the president to launch. Now, check this out. Secret, preemptive cyber warfare against any number of foreign countries. And they've been doing this since 1996.
Secret preemptive warfare, you say?
No. Secret preemptive cyber warfare.
Cyber warfare. Which,
cyber war, sorry.
Yeah, okay, again, cyber war. I mean, that's a great phrase right there.
Right, I mean...
It's like double secret probation, really.
Yeah, and there's this guy, John Arcila. He's an associate professor of the Defense Analysis of Naval Postgraduate School and an expert on unconventional warfare. And he says, that back in 1996 that we take this very seriously when government does cyber warfare. So you're saying right now that the president, our POTUS, is freezing other people's assets because they're, I guess, hacking us?
The executive order, which is something that started today, it's not from 96, but it's basically the president announcing that he has the power to seize the assets of overseas interests, as well as people seem to be supporting those overseas interests that are threatening American cyber situations of all types. So it's like if you're supporting them in any way, or if you could be seen to contributing to them, then your assets are also subject to just being grabbed without you being tried and convicted of anything.
I agree with the caller that if what Rob was saying were true here on April 1st, which I don't it was cyber true, then it would be a cyber shame and cyber cyber hypocrisy.
Cyber, get on with it.
But I don't know if I can believe anything Rob says.
You know, is it possible, and thank you, caller, for that question, is it possible, it's April 1st at the White House, too, that, you know, Obama does have a sense of humor, and you know, this could just all be a joke?
Well, and is it also, it's no wonder that we're in a day and age where this is kind of standard protocol. I mean, I think we'd be quite upset if our country wasn't able to do these things. Golly, I mean, that would really get the pundits and the analysts and stuff barking and shouting on TV and so on. So I would just point out that it's always been a bit of a wild place, that darn internet. And
it's out of control. With those anonymous people, you know, that nobody knows who they are.
I don't want to be too, you know, flippant, but it is a huge set of protocols and a massive network. And if you're a private actor, I mean, even private security companies, people acting on behalf of corporations in the U.S. have to be very careful about the kinds of testing they do because of networks here in the U.S. So there's a lot of careful treading if you are involved in security consultancies and stuff like that, as well as nations. You have nation states out there, you have private companies, you have private security people that are doing things for hire. It's a very complex situation, and there are a lot of entities interfacing on that network, and so it's no wonder that this is now kind of a regular a news story or development.
All right, well, that's going to have to do it for us here tonight on this special April 1st edition of Off the Hook. If you can't tell what's serious and what is not, welcome to our world, because it's just as crazy for us. Hey, we're going to go out with this piece from a group known as ISIS. Yes, ISIS. They were an all-women band formed out of the ashes of the earlier groups Goldie and the Gingerbreads. I'm not kidding. Couldn't make this up. And this came out in 1974. It's called April Fool. It seemed appropriate enough, didn't it? ISIS, yeah, no one remembers this group. We'll be back again in 2 weeks. Write to us, oth@2600.com. And enjoy the sounds of ISIS until then. Have a good night.
guys in the studio here at WBAI New York 99.5 FM, streaming on the web at WBAI.org, are very, very funny because it's April the 1st, 2015, and that means, being that it is Wednesday, it's time for the personal computer shoe.
Hello, world. This is Hank Key, and welcome to the Personal Computer Show. And I am still in the studio of City University of New York, or CCNY. And we didn't know where we're going to be, but today's April 1st, and this is no April Fool's joke. We are still at CCNY. And joining me this evening is Joe King. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm doing pretty good. I'd like to tell the folks that I wish that David was doing better. I just got a text from him not 5 minutes ago that
he had an accident and
that accident, he's got a lot of pain going on out there.
Yeah. Well, and then joining us, you and I, Joe, is Stevie Deeby, our inimitable asthmatic engineer.
Well, I did learn last week that I really am supposed to refer to him as Mr. Deeby.
Mr. Oh, you know why?
No.
He has a very famous daughter.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'd like to tell you a little story, Hank.
Go ahead.
A long time ago, a little girl from Long Island.
She's not that old. She's a young girl.
A long time ago, a little girl from Long Island was in her Girl Scout uniform, and she was doing things like selling Girl Scout cookies and being prepared and all the things that little girls in Girl Scout uniforms do, when lo and behold, somebody looked up and said, "This is one hell of a good girl," and they gave her the gold medal, the Girl Scouts' highest award in the whole country. It's such an important award that the New York State Senate passed a resolution congratulating her.
That's great.
So, Corinne, we knew that Corinne was something special, and we knew that something good was going to happen. And you know what happened?
Go ahead, Joe.
Go ahead.
She got a full scholarship to Howard University.
Oh, and go beyond that. That's even, you know, that's only part of the story.
No, that's just where it starts, because while she was there...
For chemical engineering.
She was taking an engineering course, I think it was chemical engineering, actually. And she was became president of the engineering club and got an award for that. And
You hear the sound of this proud father in the background.
Yeah, well, that's called in Yiddish kvelling. But that's not it, because I think it was, and Stevie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was the Ford Foundation decided that she was such a special kid that they were going to give her a scholarship and a fellowship, and she graduated with honors from Howard. And then, before you knew what happened, she was accepted for postgraduate work out at Michigan. And guess what, Hank? The National Science Foundation gave her a fellowship award.
She got a full scholarship to Michigan for chemical engineering to get her doctorate.
And she's getting her doctorate as this science research. At any rate, let me say something. There's a lot of talk about STEM, STEM, science, technology,
engineering, and math.
And that there's a lot of talk about, well, there just aren't enough women involved in it. And as a matter of fact, some idiots like Sumner up at Harvard said, well, you can't expect women to do that kind of stuff. Well, Corinne took a look. I don't know if she ever met Sumner Larry Sumner up at Harvard. But she took a look around and she said, you know something? If you want to do it and you put your mind to it and you got much more brains than your father ever had, you can do it.
Yep. And by the way,
she did.
But
I can't tell you how proud everybody who has ever heard about her is. Corinne, if you're listening to, I know you're not listening live, you may be over on the web listening, but probably you'll just download it tomorrow. From me personally, from everybody I know, congratulations, and look up the Yiddish word kvel, K-V-E-L-L. Because we're all quelling over you.
Yeah, Joe, I want to make one other comment, is that we also want the people to know that, because he hardly talks about it, but Stevie has a son.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, you know, last week we were talking about how do you clean a clean the information on a hard disk drive. And
we didn't quite finish up on that.
And just to, as a follow-up to finish up on that, in November of 2007, the National Institute of Standards published a new document on sanitization of magnetic media, and rewriting over the air is no longer acceptable. Only degaussing with NSA-approved degausser is acceptable. So that we talked about, but... I think you and I, Joe, we were talking about there's a program that I use called D-Band 2.2.8, and you know, if it doesn't have to be 100% for practical purposes, unless you think that the government is after you, you have to have it, you know, absolutely clean. Then you take a sledgehammer and just smash the smithereens.
Well, also it's a lot easier to take a sledgehammer.
Well, if you have one. I mean, not everyone has a sledgehammer at home. Okay,
you can unscrew it and take it apart.
But what we do is we hold TV upside down and just drop them head down.
Now, with a solid-state drive, that's very different, because if you keep writing over it, you're going to kill the number of the life of that drive. So there is something that is very different. It's called ATA Secure Erase. And since 2001, all solid-state drives has this capability. And what you should do is get it from the manufacturer of the drive, because each one is a little slightly different to match the hardware. It's called ATA Secure Erase. And what that does is that it flushes out the stored electrons, so it doesn't cause any reduction in the number of writes you have.
And because it's a green, really an ecologically sound product, it reuses those electrons later on. It doesn't just throw them away.
Yeah. Now, the reason why I talked about that is because, you know, I actually have a system with a solid-state drive, and when I first got it, it was very expensive, and I'm still using it. It's an 80 gig drive, and you know, there's just so much space I have, and I got to be very frugal with that
80
space.
80 gigs.
You know what? At that time when I got it, it was in the hundreds of dollars.
I got 80 gigs in my watch.
Well, you may have that, Stevie. By the way, this past week there was a whole lot of announcements about the PC industry itself, Joe, and. One of the things that, you know, with the yesterday being the end of the first quarter, it was to me and to Dr. Alfred Poor, was no surprise that we had predicted it. There was a 7% rise in notebook and, well, actually, notebook and desktop sales. 7% rise in unit sales, of which the notebook sales was 26% rise, and desktop sales was flat.
Well, when you say rise from what, Hank?
Compared to the similar quarter last year.
Ah.
And we knew it was going to go up. And however, with tablet sales, they dropped by 11%. And if you were to break that down, you'll find that the drop in tablet sales was Android dropped 34% in unit sales. That's huge.
Well, it is, but when I asked you about this some time ago, you said it was sort of expected for a couple of reasons. There are an awful lot of extremely cheap Brand X Android tablets out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you only buy one of those.
And then you're not going to buy one every year.
No, I have one. I have two that I've acquired over the last 3 years.
But so, but iPad sales also fell by 6%. So overall tablet sales, we knew it was going to go down. It hit, and the reason is you hit a saturation point, and you know, until something new or something is worn out, you're not going to replace it.
Also, and I've looked into it, Hank, and I see a lot of manufacturers agree with me. It's not when you're looking for an improvement in your tablet or a major change in your tablet. Everybody's looking for the same thing:
mm-hmm.
more battery life. It's big enough, it's got enough software, it's got good resolution. But the battery life each year has been getting better, but a little bit better. Even with the newest of the iPads, they're talking about it's now good for a full day, provided you don't work for more than 8 hours a day.
Well, you know, when you look at a glass of water, you say it's half full or half empty. And you see a lot of news about the PC market is in the toilet. Well, it depends on how you look at it. In terms of unit sales, it's gone up. However, revenues have fallen about almost 8%. And the reason is because of price cuts. So is the PC market in the toilet, even though unit sales are up? How would you call it, Joe?
Well, you talked about, you know, the glass half full, the glass half empty. I think the problem really here is that we're not talking about glasses anymore. What we're talking about is the future, and a lot of people are afraid to get deeply involved in a heavy-duty purchase. In the Microsoft world, a completely new operating system is out in the future, in the very near.
But unit sales are up, so people are buying, except that from an industry point of view, they don't look at units, they look at dollars, you know, and they don't understand that prices are coming down.
And as prices come down, there has to be a reason to spend more money. It can be software, it can be peripherals, it can be memory, storage. But so far, we used to call, if you recall, we used to ask about the killer app.
Yes, I know.
Now I'm asking about the killer hardware. What is so important out there that I would spend an extra several hundred dollars to get?
Well, now let me tell you. A couple announcements were made in the past week that you might call it killer app in terms of hardware, where the prices are down to the point where you could say, on impulse buying, you're saying, that's not a lot of money, and maybe I'll pick one up. For instance, Google announced 3 new Chromebooks. 2 of them are selling for $149 each.
And how big are they? What kind of weight do they have? How thick are they?
Well, they're 11.6-inch screen. And, you know, one of them is 2.4 pounds. The other one's about 3 pounds. But, you know, for $149, if all you want to do is get on the Internet and do some light-duty work and go to the cloud, it's doable. And especially if you have to make a presentation and all you want to be able to do is do a PowerPoint presentation and just go to the cloud to do that.
Honey, I was thinking of something totally, totally different, Hank. I was thinking, gee, it's low enough that I can get a school-age kid, I can get my nephew one, and it's not even going to...
Wait, Joe, but you're the big spender. $149, as an uncle, you can spend a little more money.
Okay? I don't want to.
Wait. By the way, I just want to tell you, in case we get a whole lot of people writing in, where can you buy these two units? Well, one is sold by Amazon for $149, and the names you're not going to recognize, okay? It's the one Amazon, it's made by Haier, H-A-I-E-R. They're an appliance manufacturer. And the other one is Hisense, which is $149, and you can go to Walmart to pick that up. So now, the third unit's interesting, Joe. It's called ASUS Chromebook Flip. So it's basically, you could treat it as a tablet or you could treat it as a notebook. And it's only 0.59 inches thick, and it weighs less than 2 pounds, and it has a touchscreen for under $250.
And when they call it the Flip, Hank, I want people to understand that what they do is they flip around or twist around the
cover so that the
monitor, so you're really looking at
right.
A tablet now.
Yeah. By the way, Microsoft, not to be outdone, has also announced the Surface 3 tablet.